It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
I'm Tom Shalhoub.
I'm Liz Peek.
I'm Charles Payne, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Friday, January 6, 2023. I'm Chris Foster. President Biden's taking his first trip to the border and expanding an illegal immigration crackdown.
It almost feels as if the White House realizes with the astronomical numbers, historic highs that have happened in the last few months, they cannot ignore it anymore.
Speaking with Fox News Sunday host Shannon Bream.
I'm Dave Anthony. 2 years after the Capitol riot, we detail the law Congress just passed to try to make challenging presidential election certifications more difficult.
I do wonder if there could be the potential for mischief in the future, but I'd say probably that this change makes that less likely, which I think is the point.
And I'm Will Cain, and I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
We have a patchwork system that simply doesn't work as it should.
In a speech about border security, President Biden announces a plan to accept 30,000 immigrants a month each from Cuba, Haiti, and Nicaragua, turning away asylum seekers who enter the country illegally. It's an expansion of a policy covering Venezuelans since last year, and their illegal crossings are down. The president visits the border, El Paso, Texas, on Sunday, ahead of the North American Leaders Summit in Mexico City, Monday and Tuesday. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton on Fox Business.
I hope it's not a stunt. I hope he actually goes and listens to mayors, elected officials, law enforcement, both federal and state, and also listens to people that actually live along the border so that he can hear what's actually going on.
It's the president's first trip to the border.
It's really interesting timing to me because it is a chaotic situation at best.
Shannon Bream's the host of Fox News Sunday.
Maybe it's to the point where the White House realizes they don't have the luxury of sort of, you know, not putting it on the front page because it's going to be there when he goes. You've got Democrats and Republicans across the spectrum who have been saying for months going into years now, we desperately need help down here. We've got to get something done. Now, what the White House will always say is day one, he's been on it. He offered up a package. But if it's not something that it can actually move legislatively that has buy-in from both sides, it's not almost even worth mentioning other than as sort of a messaging situation. But he's going to go down there and hear, I'm sure, from border agents and other people and lawmakers and ranchers and families the reality of what's going on. So it almost feels as if the White House realizes with the astronomical numbers, historic highs that have happened in the last few months, they cannot ignore it anymore. And so they might as well just grab it by the horns.
Yeah. I mean, unless this is backed up with action, like you said, it's just that the criticism will then move on to, well, this was just a photo op. He's going to Mexico City anyway for a summit with Mexico's president and the Canadian prime minister. I mean, not that Mexico City's that close. It's like 800 miles from the border. But
right.
But still, you'd think he'd be crucified if he actually went south of the border and didn't go to the border.
I think that's an excellent point. Our own Peter Ducey has called him out about why he would go to Arizona, a border state that's got a major problem with illegal immigration and, you know, real chaos at the border, and not go see it. So I think you're exactly right. And also, you can't go there and have conversations with foreign leaders and leave out this critical problem between the borders that we share.
The one way to have fewer people coming to the United States illegally is to have more people coming here legally. And that's apparently part of this White House plan. It's a little bit of both. There's been this program for Venezuelans since late last year where they let in a certain amount every month, but still turn those asylum seekers away at the border. But if you're allowed into the program, then you can come in by air, for example. Now, I guess they're going to expand that to Cuba and Haiti and Nicaragua, let more of those people in, but also turn those asylum seekers away at the border, as we do now with Mexico and some Central American countries and Venezuela. So I guess at least there's some sort of something. 30,000 a month, maybe a drop in the bucket.
Well, if there's a way to legally track them and make sure that they get assimilated into the systems and, you know, that there's an accountability for their lives and where they go and what they're doing, I think any country that has borders is going to want that, no matter how many people we want to help and to escape situations like, you know, the absolute disaster that's happening in Venezuela. I think America is a very kind-hearted country. We want to help. We want to assist. But there's also this responsibility and this question about, okay, how do we manage this responsibly so that people are funneled to the right help when they get here, and that they are, you know, a part of our country in the way that we would hope they would be. And you do have a lot of people who say, listen, it's very important to make this distinction between legal and illegal immigration. The U.S. has always supported legal immigration, but the numbers are so overwhelming on the illegal immigration side. We have to look at some real pragmatic ways that could potentially be helpful. We are years behind on immigration hearings. If we want to tell people, you got to come here legally, but they're not going to see a judge for years and years and years, and there are hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of cases backed up, that's not a fix. I mean, if we want to bring people here and give them a chance at life and the American experience and opportunity, we have to be responsible in the way that that happens. But you know, when I talk to folks on both sides of the aisle about, okay, what could you come to the table and agree on? You know, Republicans say, until we secure the border, nothing else. And Democrats will say, well, until we find a way to help the people who are already here, some form of amnesty or grandfathering them in, we're not going to budge. But by the president going to the border, he's going to put pressure on both sides to actually try to do something.
We've been talking about what we're talking about here, this keeping asylum seekers at the border. Title 42 is what it's called. Now, the stated goal was COVID safety. It seems like there's a bit of a reversal here with the Biden administration. First, they were arguing to let that program end, and now they're instead expanding it. Is it a reversal? It's a little confusing to me. The Supreme Court ruled that Title 42 can stay in place. They're going to hear arguments about it in a month or two.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things that it's easy when you're on the campaign trail to say, these policies are horrible and they hurt XYZ. And the minute I am president, we will change all that. Then you get to the White House, whether you're Republican or Democrat, get the reality of the situation and realize like, whoa, okay, this administration had argued against Title 42, said it's barbaric, it's not helpful to people who are trying to come here and seek help. But when it came time to legally defend it, there was a lot of back and forth. And when it got to the Supreme Court on this emergency expedited basis, they essentially said, okay, give us a little bit more time to plan for the lifting of it. So on principle, we think it's terrible and want to get rid of it. But we need a little bit more time to figure out what we're going to do when you do lift it. So the Supreme Court has not ruled on the merits. As you noted, they've just kind of put the whole thing on hold until they hear arguments probably in February, March, somewhere in there. And we'll see. But Title 42, you know, there was a dissent from those who thought that they shouldn't keep Title 42 in place. One of the dissents, Justice Gorsuch wrote, Justice Jackson signed on to, and he said, when we have all these policies in place that are for one emergency, but not for another, that's not how this works. Meaning this was in place for COVID. We're signaling and telegraphing that the worst of that is over, the quote unquote emergency is over. But the chaos at the border is a different emergency. So you can't use one policy to fix another that was never intended to address it.
Yeah. Back along in the beginning of the Biden administration, Vice President Harris, this was supposed to be her part of her portfolio, work on the border. I know she's had some meetings with Central American leaders. Is there any sense that there's been any movement on her part there at all?
Her critics would say no. I mean, she's, and the White House will say she's not about solving the border. She's about addressing the root causes of what's causing the overwhelm and the crowds at the border. But her critics will say she hasn't been effective on that front. You know, her team in the White House will say there's been constant effort. There is constant movement and conversation. Again, this piece of legislation the White House offered up, the president offered up early on, but there are no tangible results that show any success. I think if you're just strictly going by numbers that come from nonpartisan agencies, the federal government, to say this is where we're at, the numbers would suggest that there hasn't been progress on the underlying causes. If anything, they're absolutely skyrocketing and moving in the wrong direction. So it's going to be hard for this administration to show any or claim any wins on the border to this point.
Yeah, and I guess her supporters' defense would be, look, you know, her job is also the long game, so we may not,
right.
You're not going to see immediate benefits. Talk about student loans for a bit. The Supreme Court is hearing challenges next month to the Biden administration forgiving some student loan debt. Millions of borrowers are in limbo. Payments have been suspended since COVID. Where are we there?
So, I mean, the White House is also, the executive branch has said, we're going to suspend this whole thing to somewhere in the neighborhood of January 30th. They know the court is going to rule probably in that time frame. So it's going to come to a head this summer. In the meantime, you know, the argument from the administration continues to be, as you mentioned, we've left all these people in limbo. They have uncertainty about what's going on with their loans and what they should do. But the other side of that's going to argue the executive branch doesn't get to just set up a new policy knowing it will be legally challenged. And then when it is, say, oh no, all these people are left in limbo. I mean, you're the one who started the change to this situation that launched the legal action that has now launched everyone into limbo. So I don't know that the court is going to buy that argument. This court has been, you know, in the years I've been covering it, very skeptical of executive action that they think more rightly belongs with the legislative branch. And that's going to be the argument here, is that, you know, Congress alone had the power to do something to these programs. The executive branch didn't really have the authority under what they're using to make these changes. But I expect some really vigorous arguments at the court that last week of February to see where this goes. In the meantime, everything remains on hold.
Yeah. And these two lawsuits argue that the president is exceeding his legal authority here. The Biden administration says, well, you don't have standing to sue because you're not being harmed. What does it hurt you if we forgive some of these student loans?
Yeah. And we have, you know, two different tracks, as you mentioned. So you've got a number of red states that have come forward to say that this causes a problem for them. You've also got a private group that's representing a couple of borrowers who say that they are actually going to be impacted by these decisions that are made. So it'll be interesting to see how much that issue of standing gets. I don't think the court would take the case if they thought it was dead on the standing issue, meaning these plaintiffs weren't the right ones to be in court. I think they have to be entertaining at least some possibility that they do have standing so they can actually get to the merits. Otherwise, it's a gigantic waste of everyone's time.
Shannon, it's the second anniversary of the January 6th riot at the Capitol. We've gotten this report now from the House committee investigating what happened there, largely blames former President Trump. I venture a guess, though, that very, very, very few Americans have read a word of that report.
I think you're right. Although something that popped up in my feed this morning said January 6th report, automatic, you know, incredible first bestseller at first run. So there's definitely some appetite for it out there. But I think people who are pretty hardcore into the political junkie kind of world, they made up their minds a long time ago about whether or not this committee was doing something of substance or of value. There are those who will say, absolutely. We learned a lot of new information. We heard from a lot of new voices who were directly involved and tangentially involved with this whole thing. And it gave us a roadmap of some things that went very wrong and potentially how to avoid these things in the future. The other side will say, it was a terrible day, but we learned nothing new. It was partisan. You did have, you know, Republicans Cheney and Kinzinger on the panel. But there was nobody there defending President Trump and those from the White House and others who were considered, quote unquote, on the other side of what happened on January 6th. So there are those who are going to think it was helpful and, you know, provided good information that will help the DOJ in its potential prosecution of the former president and others. And the other side, it's going to say that it was completely political exercise. That said, I don't know how many people are actually reading the report, but it's out there.
Shannon Bream, host of Fox News Sunday. Happy New Year.
And to you.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor and editor of the Transom.com daily newsletter. And I'm inviting you to join a conversation every week. It's the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Subscribe and listen now by going to FoxNewsPodcasts.com.
This is Will Cain with your Fox News commentary coming up.
Let's get back to January 6th. 2 years ago.
Mike Pence is going to have to come through for us. And if he doesn't, that will be a sad day for our country.
That was President Trump refusing to concede he lost the election, telling his supporters that day,
I know that everyone here will soon be marching over to the Capitol building to peacefully and patriotically make your voices heard.
They did more than that. They went on to storm the Capitol and get inside, interrupting the Electoral College certification, clashing with police for hours until Congress resumed its work. And with Vice President Pence presiding and refusing to block any votes, Joe Biden was certified the winner. Congresswoman Liz Cheney, on the House committee that investigated the Capitol riot, blames Trump for it.
He is unfit for any office.
Well, Trump calls her a thug and a hack and the investigation a witch hunt, and he's running for president again. As the committee recommends, the Justice Department charge the former president criminally, like more than 900 rioters have been. Congress has also made a change to try to prevent a repeat in the future. Tucked into that massive omnibus spending bill last year, funding the government, was the Electoral Reform Act, updating an 1887 law on certifying presidential elections.
Donald Trump was really leaning on his vice president, Mike Pence, to sort of intervene in the process. And Pence, I think, correctly understood that his role was ceremonial, but the law was kind of hazy on that.
Kyle Condick is managing editor of Sabatow's Crystal Ball at the University of Virginia Center for Politics.
If you were essentially acting in bad faith, you could argue that the vice president did have some sort of authority to, you know, throw out the electoral votes or question electoral votes or that sort of thing. And this new law sort of clarifies that the VP really is just presiding over this in very much a ceremonial way. It also raises the threshold for making, objections to the electoral votes cast by certain states. It raises to a fifth of the members in both the House and the Senate. And, you know, we had a lot of objections, particularly in the House in 2020 over the results. But in some past election years, of course, it was Republicans doing that in 2020. You did have some of that going on with Democrats in both 2004 and 2016. Frankly, I don't think there were any particularly great arguments made that the votes were somehow fraudulent or that sort of thing. And so, you do still have a way for Congress to address legitimate concerns about the vote, but it does sort of raise the bar.
Let's get into some of that. Before this law, the one that goes way back to the 1800s, one member of the House, one member of the Senate can object and start the process, like we saw what happened back on January 6th, 2 years ago. But now you said one-fifth. So we're talking about, 80 members of the House or more that would have to object? Is my math right? Something like that?
And then, of course,
20 senators. Yeah.
20 in the Senate. And so, what I would say is that if a party has like a legitimate criticism and there's some unity within the party, they could still bring it up and the Congress can still sort of hash it out. But I think it probably will raises the bar as to maybe limiting this to criticisms that are maybe more, grounded in reality than I think what we saw in 2020. And also, I think clarifying this law, I think that the rioters, some of them legitimately believe that there was something that could be done that day to change the vote when really there wasn't. If the law was really being followed, maybe that changes this perception. Although, again, a lot of the people who showed up at the Capitol were bad actors and now are convicted criminals. So, if people are going to do that, they're going to do that. I suspect that the authorities at the Capitol will be more aware of the potential of that happening. Like we saw sort of in the, in the aftermath of January 6th, sort of a, much more of a security presence around the Capitol, which on one hand is unfortunate, but I think also is probably necessary these days.
One of the other things is there was this effort to try to get states to put up an alternate slate of electors. And what this new Reform Act does is the state has to follow the laws before the election. You can't make changes after the election to try to get an alternate slate.
Yeah, basically the authority, as I understand it, the authority would reside in the governor to sort of certify that slate of electors was the right one and there aren't going to be other slates. Again, I still wonder if there may be the possibility for sort of bad behavior at some point, but, I sort of trust in the fact that I think this was negotiated, again, in a good faith way between, I think, responsible members of both parties. And that I think they're hopeful that this will sort of help things move forward in a more positive way for 2024. We don't have a national electorate in this country. Everything is there are elections at the state level, even for federal races. And so, it's not like in like France or something, for instance, there's a national election and everybody votes and the election is, conducted by the federal government or the national government. But, here it just doesn't work that way. And so, again, I do wonder if there could be the potential for mischief in the future. But I'd say probably that this change makes that less likely, which I think is the point.
Let's broaden this out to the Electoral College itself. There are a lot of people, especially Democrats, who want to get rid of it. After all, the last two Republican presidents won elections, getting the Electoral College majority, despite losing the majority of the popular vote. George W. Bush in 2000 and Donald Trump in 2016. That has also happened three other times. In 1824, 1876, and 1888. And there is an ongoing attempt to prevent that from happening again. Something called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. 15 states and the District of Columbia have all signed on to it. Their electoral votes add up to 195. If more states join, and it gets up to 270, the compact goes into effect, and every state that's in it agrees. Whichever candidate gets the most votes nationwide is awarded the state's electoral votes, effectively electing a president by popular vote. But Kyle Condon doubts enough states will join.
At a certain point, you start, you know, as you get higher in the electoral vote count, you start moving out of the blue states into the like purple or even reddish leaning states. And it's hard to identify logical candidates that would sign on to this thing that would add up to 270 electoral votes. I mean, you know, maybe we get there at some point, but it seems like it's sort of stalled out a little bit.
Okay.
But, you know, that effort is still ongoing and it's still out there.
Yeah, because each state in that compact, even if, let's say, the Republican won that state, if the Democrat won the national popular vote, that state's electors would have to go to the Democrat.
Well, but, you know, here's the thing, too, though. Just think about this. If you, let's say you have a state that signed on to this compact and what you described happens. What if that state had a, you know, Republican-controlled state government at that time? Would they really go along with it, or would they, you know, back out? Would they change the law or something?
But how do you do that again after the election?
Well, you know, logistically speaking, it's kind of tricky. I also kind of wonder if this new legislation would maybe prevent that from happening. Although it's also something that maybe a state could sort of could maybe try to identify in advance. I just think it's, again, even if you got the 270 electoral votes, I don't think it would necessarily be ironclad.
The Electoral College's purpose, though, way back when, was to do what with the election? What was the goal? I've read somewhere that they really believed that this was going to lead to the House ultimately having to decide who the president will be, which is what a lot of them wanted. They didn't believe in popular vote because a lot of people didn't vote in those days. You had to own property. You had to be male. It was a very different electorate than there is today.
Yeah, and really, like, the actual, you know, the sort of presidential elections becoming about even who, you know, people who are eligible to vote, you know, white men, basically, you know,
with money,
even really see that, you know, the sort of mass democracy that we've sort of come accustomed to. And of course, it's the franchises has expanded over the years, but you don't really start seeing that until really like the Jacksonian period, which was several decades. It's the 1820s. And
well, he was the first president. He was the first guy to lose in the Electoral College. Right. But that election did go to the House.
Yeah,
that was an absolute mess.
And you sort of see the expansion of kind of direct, you know, or sort of more direct election of the, you know, the president at that time. But I don't think the Electoral College was designed as a scheme in which it would sort of just be like a funnel for mass democracy, which is basically what we have now. And then you also get into the reality that which has, you know, been true forever, that, you know, there are some competitive states for president, but there are a whole lot of states that aren't competitive. And the voters in those states, particularly if you're, you know, if you're like a Republican in New York or if you're, you know, a Democrat in Nebraska, like, you know, or in Kansas or whatever, like, you know, chances are your vote isn't really going to matter all that much. And, you know, we had seven states in 2020 decided by less than 3 points. Biden won six of those seven. Those same states in 2016, Trump won six of those seven. You know, those are some of the states we're going to be looking at this time. You know, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Arizona, Georgia, North Carolina, Nevada. But, you know, outside of some of those states and a handful of others, you know, a lot of the states aren't really that competitive. So it's a national election decided at the state level and really decided only in a handful of key swing states. So, again, it's not the sort of system you design from scratch if you were starting over again.
If we did, though, scrap the Electoral College and it was just whoever wins the popular vote, period, what would that do to campaigning, do you think?
Well, you probably would see, you know, candidates' travel schedules not be so focused on these key swing states.
Would they just go to big cities and population centers?
Yeah, you might be going all over the country. Although even then, you know, the big cities are, you know, there are a lot of Republicans in New York City, for instance, but it's a Democratic dominated place. And, you know, there are Democrats out in rural areas, too, but they're dominated by Republicans. But you'd probably see a more kind of nationalized campaign, you know, which would sort of change the, you know, the campaigning. And also, like, you know, it's easy to say, oh, well, and this is maybe what some Republicans would say, and I don't know how good of an argument it is, but I think it's one you need to consider, that if, in fact, there was no Electoral College in 2016, both Bush and Trump would have, and Gore and Clinton would have campaigned in different kinds of ways, and maybe that leads to a different outcome. you know, maybe the turnout patterns are different. Maybe more people are engaged in uncompetitive states than otherwise would be. You just don't know until the law actually changes. You know, you would also have, you know, just from a logistical standpoint, because it's not an election conducted at, it's sort of a one federal jurisdiction rather as a you know, collection of 50 states plus DC. If it was super close, you would have to have a mechanism to do recounts in every state and that sort of thing, which would, you know, would take time and be expensive. The results would be delayed to some degree. We all know there's always a lot of conspiracy mongering when results are delayed. So there are some logistical issues with it.
Well, doesn't sound like it's going to change anytime soon.
No, I don't think so.
Kyle Condick, managing editor at Sabatow's Crystal Ball at the University of Virginia Center for Politics. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And now, some good news with Tanya J. Powers.
A viral TikTok post has given an 82-year-old Maryland Walmart worker the gift of financial freedom. Last month, Rory McCarty went to the Walmart in Cumberland, Maryland for some batteries. That's where he met Butch Marion, who was working the cash register in his checkout line. Marion, who's 82, is a Navy veteran, has already retired once several years ago to help take care of his ex-wife's husband before he passed away. After that, he went back to work at Walmart, where he's been averaging about 30 hours a week. McCarty, who is an avid TikTok user, made a TikTok post when he bought his batteries, and it got millions of views. Then he set up a GoFundMe for Marion, which took only days to reach the goal, making it possible for Marion to retire again. This week, McCarty presented Marion with a check.
It's got your name on it for $108,682.85.
Wow.
Love you, man.
I love you.
Marion says the money will go to pay off bills and fund a trip to Florida so he can see his daughters and grandchildren he hasn't hugged in years. Tanya J. Powers, Fox News.
Put the power of over 100 meteorologists and the worldwide resources of Fox in your hands with the Fox Weather Podcast. Precise, personal, powerful. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com.
It's time for your Fox News commentary. Will Cain.
What's on your mind?
Hey, it's Will Cain of the Will Cain Podcast. Look, you always want to keep the first thing the first thing. But that doesn't mean you deny the existence of the second and third thing. Damar Hamlin, according to his doctors, is on the road to recovery, including regaining full neurological function. The training and medical staff at the NFL stadium on Monday night might have just saved the life of Buffalo Bills safety Damar Hamlin. Well, that and the power of prayer of individuals across this nation. And that is absolutely the first thing, the health and life of Damar Hamlin. But the second and third thing still exist. Reports are the NFL is considering canceling the game between the Bills and the Bengals. How does that affect the NFL season? I mean, you can't really be chastised for acknowledging the existence of the issue, the thought in everybody's minds, the debate being had in NFL offices, and the literal conversations coming out of people's mouth. Do you just give the number one seed to the Kansas City Chiefs? Do you just vacate their records for the Bills and the Bengals? A tie? A nothing? Just one less game? For that matter, what happens to the millions of dollars gambled on that game? Returned to bettors? What about fantasy football championships taking place that weekend? Again, millions of dollars. If you had big-time players, Burrow, Allen, Diggs, playing, their points don't count, it's over, too bad. Millions of dollars exchange hands on a game that's canceled? I don't know the answers to these questions. I just know they're real questions. And then we can walk and chew gum at the same time with real ramifications. We can care about and acknowledge the existence of the second and third thing while still keeping the first thing, and that is being thankful for the answer to our prayers on the health and the life of Damar Hamlin. For more on this and other issues, including the chaos in the House, download, rate, review, subscribe to the Will Cain Podcast right here at Fox News Podcast.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. Did you hear the news? Now you can. With instant updates from Fox News for Amazon Alexa. Just say,
Alexa, play news from Fox.
In Fox News.
It's the latest when you need it. On demand from Fox News and Amazon Alexa. Kudlow on Fox Business is now on the go for podcast fans. Get key interviews with the biggest business newsmakers of the day. The Kudlow podcast will be available on the go after the show every weekday at foxbusinesspodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.